This weekend starts right after this.
As a business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
How much money is made on an airline ticket? I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. First full weekend in March. Glad you could join us. Here's what we have for you this hour.
If the average airline ticket is $355, how much of that is actual profit? We'll have the math.
Since serial killings are down, are mass killings the newest murder trend?
With the Oscars on Sunday night, could you join the ranks of the extremists, the movie lovers who see all 59 nominated films? Hear how they do it.
And solving the corruption in college sports.
Athletes aren't the only people in a university environment who get scholarships. There are academic scholarships, there are scholarships for the creative arts and so on. If you're getting a scholarship because you're a tremendous violinist, they'll turn around and say to that violinist, oh, well, if you go out and play a birthday party on the weekend, you can't pocket any of that money, or you can't work a side job. College athletes, they do.
Wall Street Journal sports writer Jason Gay says the problem in college sports is not secret cash. His report in about 25 minutes. As we psychoanalyze the school shooting at Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida, here's a question. With serial killings down sharply, according to some statistics, are mass killers the new serial killers? Thought-provoking piece by Ethan Epstein, associate editor at The Weekly Standard. Ethan, what's the difference?
With a serial killer, they're all psychopaths. That's like literally a clinical term. It's not just a term of abuse, okay. Which means that a person's unable to feel empathy. There's some other things that are true of all serial killers, or almost all of them. One is that there's almost always a sexual element to what they do. Mass shooters, now, a few of them have been psychopaths, but usually they're people that feel like the normal range of human emotions. Like, they're capable of empathy, they're capable of jealousy, of rage. And so it seems like it's just that their emotions are kind of pushed to a level of violent extremism that you don't normally see. But, you know, they tend to be quite different from the serial killer profile.
Mm. Well, right out of the gate in the piece, you mentioned Nicholas Cruz, the accused gunman in Florida of, as we've read before, killing animals or torturing animals. Is that a common theme among mass killers or, say, even serial killers?
So, again, that was actually another thing that sort of got me rolling on the story was I knew that was a common thing that serial killers do, like Jeffrey Dahmer famously tortured animals. So what it turns out is that tends to be a predictor of violence in general later in life. What it does not tell you is what kind of violence that's going to be.
Okay.
So it's really not surprising that someone that turned out to be, you know, a killer of many humans, like Nicholas Cruz, would have begun his quote unquote career killing animals as well. Unfortunately.
Wow. That said, if it
a
was
happy subject, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if that said, I mean, if this was known. Right, that he had done this for some time.
Yes.
Boy, how far back can you go saying we failed to address the signs?
Well, you know, this one in particular, let me back up and say, usually in the case of mass killings, there is some indication that this guy is, you know, there's something off of him, he's violent, a lot of them start as domestic abusers. So I would point out that the Las Vegas guy, that one's a true mystery because he didn't really show many of those signs.
Right, right.
Cruz, however, had a lot of the classic signs. It wasn't just animals. I mean, he was made threats, he was violent at school. And as we know, it turns out that the sheriff's department in Broward County visited the house he lived in, you know, literally dozens of times, apparently. If there was ever a case where people could say they would see it coming from a mile away, this seems to be it.
We're speaking with Ethan Epstein, associate editor at The Weekly Standard. He's written a piece entitled The Monster Next Door. You made an interesting point, too, about avoiding detection when it comes to serial killers versus mass shooters.
Yes. Yeah, so serial killers, they like to operate in secret. For one, that allows them to keep doing what they enjoy, which is the killing themselves, the killing itself. But it also turns out that in a lot of cases, they actually kind of they kind of get off on being able to trick society, too.
Okay.
So, for one, the killer's not found, which, you know, is a little feather in their cap. But also, serial killers tend to be, like, you know, respected members of their community. And what you ultimately find out when they're finally caught is, like, this whole time they've been sort of secretly laughing at the rest of us idiots who hadn't picked up on the fact
that
the guy that lived down the street was actually the serial killer.
You think, has anybody said that there are, I don't know, lessons learned here that may help us prevent this in the future? Because it doesn't seem like there's anything unique that's come out of this in terms of signs, right?
The big lesson here is that it's clear that people are becoming mass killers because there's a kind of contagion. So does that mean that the media need to stop, mentioning these people by name? And that's something that's been discussed. You know, don't show their picture, don't mention them by name. But it's obvious that one kind of leads to the next, which isn't the case with serial killers, where those people tend to be sort of born that way. So unfortunately, it's going to take a kind of significant societal change, which, you know, that's not an easy thing to achieve. And, you know, we're really just starting to figure out what we can do about that, I think.
You think, has anybody said that there are, I don't know, lessons learned here that may help us prevent this in the future? Because it doesn't seem like there's anything unique that's come out of this in terms of signs, right?
The big lesson here is that it's clear that people are becoming mass killers because there's a kind of contagion. So does that mean that the media need to stop, mentioning these people by name? That's something that's been discussed. You know, don't show their picture, don't mention them by name. But it's obvious that one kind of leads to the next, which isn't the case with serial killers, where those people tend to be sort of born that way. So unfortunately, it's going to take a kind of significant societal change, which, you know, that's not an easy thing to achieve.
Thanks, Ethan. Ethan Epstein, associate editor at The Weekly Standard. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending time with us. Lent, the period between Ash Wednesday and Easter Sunday, is a time for people of many Christian religious traditions to fast, pray, and serve others in preparation for Easter. Different churches suggest different practices, but many involve giving up something that you enjoy, which makes any sort of reward feel slightly wrong for some people. For example, if your motivation is to lose weight or improve your health, then Lent is about you and not about God, they argue. Wall Street Journal columnist Claire Ansberry has written a piece about it. Claire, set this up.
Well, I've been seeing a lot of things online, a lot of health and fitness sites that had things like, you know, if you give up these 10 unhealthy foods, how many calories are you going to save? And, you know, it was interesting that in and of itself, but then it just started making me wonder, you know, are you giving it up to save that 2,000 calories in French fries for 6 weeks, or is that the real purpose or the motivation? Mm. And I found that a lot of people, they don't like to really admit that they hope to lose weight, because that kind of goes counter to a whole season that's associated with self-denial. So if it's self-denial and you really are hoping that by the end you weigh 10 pounds lighter, is there kind of a conflict or something that doesn't seem comfortable?
It's interesting, because it's very popular to give up food, right? If there were a survey, I'd imagine that's the top thing in Lent.
Yeah. I mean, the three pillars of Lent are the fasting and the almsgiving, which is charity, and the prayer. But most people are not saying, you know, I'm going to go to church every day. They're saying, I'm going to give up alcohol or something like that. So people really gravitate towards the unhealthy foods. Social media, too, though, is something that's coming up a lot, where people are saying, I'll give up social media, or at least looking at it all through the day, maybe just checking it once. But it seems to be a time that, you know, if you blew it on your New Year's resolutions, here's another time to start all over, or a time to get rid of bad habits. One woman was saying that she felt like one of the reasons that people do this it's spring, so people are looking for new beginnings. And also, 40 days, which is sort of the Lenten fast period, it's 46 days, but 40 days if you don't include Sunday. But it's a short period of time, and people can say, all right, I can give up, alcohol or my daily glass of wine for 40 days, whereas if it's the beginning of the new year, they may not last that long.
Right. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal columnist Claire Ansberry. She wrote a piece entitled, Is That Lenten Diet for God or for You? How about a couple of the priests you spoke to? What did they say about this?
Well, you know, nobody wants anybody to feel guilty about motivations, and it's really hard to question somebody's motivations. And, you know, if becoming a better and healthier person is the result, then, you know, there's not anything wrong with that, and you shouldn't feel bad about it. But they're also saying, but if that's your only motivation, you know, there's so much more that you that could help you, and, you know, there's a deeper purpose, and, you know, that's fine to give up extra guacamole, but, you know, there's a lot more, and you could do a lot more. But they feel like it's, you know, it's a step, and nobody's going to come down on you if, you know, you're, what you do is not what somebody else might do.
All right, thanks, Claire. Wall Street Journal columnist Claire Ansberry. 20 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The best place to start or grow your business is at michiganbusiness.org. Contact them today. We're in a period of record-breaking profits for the airline industry, with a big boost the past few years from baggage fees, seat fees, reservation change fees, etc. But how much profit do they earn per person or per ticket? Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
When you fly, airlines are making a lot of money off you. How much? Scott McCartney, Middle Sea columnist for The Wall Street Journal, is here to tell us more. Scott, what kind of money are we talking about here?
Well, we did a lot of number crunching, and when you really boil down to it, every time you board an airplane, airlines in the U.S. are earning about $20 a head. Just think of, you know, slipping that $20 into the tip jar when you get on the airplane. Last year is actually $17.75. Over 4 years, it's averaged $19.65. So we decided to call it $20.
How does that compare with maybe some other businesses?
You know, profit margins in the airline industry overall in the U.S. averaging about 9%. For last year, for 2017. And you know, that's about average. There's certainly lots of companies that earn less than that. A Walmart, a grocery store with low margins. Last year, FedEx was at 5%. And lots of companies that earn margins in the 20% range, not just tech companies, but others as well. So it looks about average, and average is a huge improvement for airlines, which, you know, for many years earnings were non-existent. And if you looked over time, you know, they sort of squeak out a small profit over many years. But it's really changed in the last 4 or 5 years, where they're producing significant profits.
Scott, you talk about them not making such a profit in the past. I remember years past that fuel hedging and how much an impact fuel prices have had on airplanes. Has that changed over the last year or so with prices coming down?
Yeah, it has. Well, oil prices actually have gone up. So they were squeezing airline margins last year. The peak of airline earnings was really 2015. 2016 was gangbusters as well. 2017 down some, largely because of fuel prices, also because of rising labor costs. And the expectation is that fuel prices will be up maybe 10% in 2018. So you've seen airline chief executives, Doug Parker at American, for example, talking publicly about the need, he thinks, for tickets to go up in price to keep airline earnings strong and cover that higher cost that they're facing.
We're speaking with Scott McCartney of the Wall Street Journal. Scott, when we buy a ticket, what actually are we paying for?
Well, technically, you're paying for transportation from A to B. You're not paying for a particular seat until you buy a seat fee, and even that doesn't guarantee you a seat. The average ticket price is about $355 in the U.S. And we calculated that off of airline financial reports, so it doesn't include the taxes and fees. It actually raised that average price some. I think if you what you're paying for is the cost of the airplane, the expensive cost of the labor, all of the business office folks, all the people that are sitting there manipulating fares and setting fees and all that kind of stuff. You're paying for all of their offices and insurance and their taxes, although many of them still don't pay taxes because of the losses in the past. And so, you know, it's a big, expensive business, capital-intensive business. You're paying for a lot of interest on the borrowing that they do to actually have the airplanes.
Scott, we hate the fees, but somehow the airlines are getting away with the baggage, the seat fees, the reservation change fees. How is this working for them?
Yeah, this is really the key to their healthy financial results. You can kind of think of it as the ticket cost actually covers their costs, and their profit comes from baggage fees, reservation change fees, seat fees, early boarding fees, all of that stuff, paying really high fees to take your pet on board unless you do the service animal end-around, which we've certainly seen a lot of people do. This has worked for airlines because they can advertise low prices and then upsell. And when, you know, travel is a very price-sensitive business, if the ticket price is $50 higher, fewer people are going to travel, and they're not going to buy as many seats, and that that forces airlines to raise ticket prices higher to cover costs and try and maintain healthy prices. And so what they found is they'll hook you with that low price and then get you for $50 or $40 or $30 or whatever in extra fees, and that's where they're making their money.
Wall Street Journal columnist Scott McCartney with this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka, 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. If you want the absolute best shirts around, you have to go to CT Shirts. I want you to try them because once you do, you'll never go back to some random shirt off the shelf of a department store. And CT Shirts come in custom sizes, so you're not messing with ill-fitted sleeve lengths or neck sizes. It's time to step up your game and look your best, so I got you a special CT Shirts deal. 3 CT Shirts for $99. CT Shirts use the softest, most exquisite fabrics ever. Work or casual, tie or no tie, tuck or untucked, when you're wearing a CT shirt, you'll look your best. Here's the deal. 1 CT shirt normally costs $100, but right now you get 3 shirts for just $99. That's 60% off. Go to ctshirts.com/deal. And CT Shirts come with free delivery, a 6-month quality guarantee, and free returns. If you hurry, $99 gets you 3 amazing CT shirts. ctshirts.com/deal. That's ctshirts.com/deal.
Thanks for being with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka on this first weekend in March. Coming up this half hour, notifying the IRS of every Bitcoin purchase, even a cup of coffee. Also, why Beanie Babies have not become the valuable collector's items, and the Oscar extremists who see all 59 nominated films before the awards ceremony. That report in about 20 minutes. The rot in college basketball is being exposed, and while it's not pretty, it's not shocking to most who follow college athletics. Recently, Yahoo Sports revealed financial details from the FBI's investigation into who's getting paid, how it's done, how extensive it is. ESPN recently reported that government wiretaps allegedly caught Arizona coach Sean Miller discussing a $100,000 payment to secure a player. Is this fixable, or are those in control enjoying too many benefits? Here's Wall Street Journal sports writer Jason Gay. Jason, how do you see this?
Gordon, I don't want to, like, you know, break any illusions you have, but college sports might not be entirely on the level. I don't know if that bursts your bubble, but the latest, you know, we've been following this FBI investigation of bribery and fraud charges in college basketball, and in the last couple of days, we've seen stories from Yahoo Sports and from ESPN about, you know, the extensiveness of some of the allegations about, you know, athletes getting paid, coaches funneling players to the sport, to the school, rather. And while the individual issues are, you know, they vacillate from, you know, rinky-dink to mildly disturbing, you know, the big issue here is, like, what is this business here? What is college sports in 2018? And I think that
increasingly people look around at the environment, they know the money, and they see this multi-billion dollar economy in which everybody's allowed to participate but one, which is these athletes.
Yeah.
And so, of course, Gordon, you have this black market economy where athletes are getting paid at the table. Of course you have coaches funneling money to runners to secure the talents of a player, even for just a few months. This is the name of the game, man. You know, the name of the game is winning, it's exposure, it's making money. And when colleges sort of agree to that environment, it was only a matter of time before you saw this kind of stuff. And let's be honest here, this kind of stuff, what we're talking about, payments, runners, you know, that kind of stuff, has been around college sports for generations now. This is certainly not a new development. What's interesting here is that we're seeing a much bigger sort of look under the hood at all the sort of entangled wires and really understanding what the engine of the sport is now.
Explain the example you gave about the creative writing student who may be on scholarship. It's okay for that student to get published in, say, a magazine of some kind and collect payment. What makes that different from a college basketball player taking a sponsorship, for example?
Listen, all of us who've written about this topic will hear from readers and say, look, you know, a college scholarship is not a small thing. Look, in 2018, you know, to send a kid to a four-year school with, you know, fees and books and tuition, housing, everything, you know, you're talking 200 grand plus in a lot of cases. That's not small change. Absolutely true. However, athletes aren't the only people in a university environment who get scholarships. There are academic scholarships, there are scholarships for the creative arts and so on. If you're getting a scholarship because you're a tremendous violinist, and there are, those people do exist, they don't turn around and say to that violinist, oh, well, if you go out and play a birthday party on the weekend, you can't pocket any of that money, or you can't work a side job. College athletes, they do. Why do they do that? Because the sort of, you know, big, you know, sham of college athletics is this idea of amateurism, of these athletes being pristine. And it serves as this nonsense way that the NCAA and, you know, a lot of schools continue to see themselves in the face of what is nakedly a multi-billion dollar economy.
Mm. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal sports writer Jason Gay. He's written a piece entitled Secret Cash Isn't an NCAA Scandal, Amateurism Is. All right, you two talked about kind of the Olympics. They survived allowing amateur athletes to grab all kinds of sponsorship and things. You think that's where this is going for college football and basketball players?
Yeah, rare opportunity to say something positive about the International Olympic Committee, but it's true that, you know, going back several decades now, this debate raised within the Olympic movement whether or not to allow Olympic athletes to shed their amateur status and take on sponsorships to accept appearance fees for running and track meets in Europe, if that was going to ruin the Olympics. There were certainly people arguing that. We've seen very, very clearly that nobody cares. It's okay. Chloe Kim has a Oakley sponsorship. Sean White's with Burton Snowboards. There are a zillion of them with Nike and Adidas and so on. It's fine. You know, people still get revved up for the Winter Games, for the Summer Games. It hasn't taken anything off the Olympics at all. So there is some precedent for, you know, making that concession in college sports. And what I like about that, Gordon, is that that can be just a broad brush across all college sports. You know, one of the issues with, you know, separating out college football and college men's basketball here is that, you know, there are a great many other college athletes out there who are working very hard. You know, what's in it for them? Something like allowing athletes to make money on the side, allowing them to accept sponsorship dollars, that could be applied to everybody. Now, I'm not saying a badminton scholarship athlete is going to make the kind of loot that, you know, a college quarterback could potentially make.
Why might the system not change?
Because the parties that are empowered are the parties that are making the most out of this. You know, specifically the NCAA, conferences, the schools, the coaches. You know, you're talking about cutting in a new party here, which means less money for everybody. It's a real pain in the neck to sort this out. It's probably going to have to be taken to court, you know, in terms of trying to sort out what the Title IX implications are of it.
Yeah.
So, you know, inertia has been a very attractive option for a very long time because it's hard. It's hard, but hard is not an excuse to do nothing.
Well said, sports writer Jason Gay at the Wall Street Journal. 19 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for joining us. Many people holding Bitcoin have seen massive gains, right? Some becoming overnight millionaires recently. But now comes the less fun part, paying taxes. Do you need to file paperwork for your cryptocurrency holdings? The short answer is yes. Anybody involved in cryptocurrency transactions should be paying taxes on them, meaning everything you bought with Bitcoin needs to be reported. Here's a quick lesson from MarketWatch reporter Carrie Paul, who covers personal finance. Carrie, what should we know?
So a lot of people have made some big gains in the Bitcoin world in the past year. Its value has soared over 1,000% since the beginning of last year. So there's a lot of tax issues that come into play when you're making a lot of money in this realm.
You know what I didn't realize, too, is that for every Bitcoin transaction, the IRS has to be notified. Explain why. That's Bitcoin is considered property, right?
Right. As of now, Bitcoin is still considered property, not a currency. So each transaction you make is technically classified as you selling property and then using the proceeds of that to buy something.
That's unbelievable. I mean, that could be a lot of paperwork.
Right. Yeah. It depends on how many transactions you've made. It depends on what exchanges you're using, where you're making those transactions. But as a rule, you should be just reporting each transaction that you make.
Even buying a cup of coffee, right?
Right. You technically should be reporting each and every small purchase.
Wow.
And the big ones, of course.
We're speaking with personal finance reporter Carrie Paul at MarketWatch. She's written a piece entitled, Sorry, America, but you have to pay taxes on your Bitcoin. Here's how. Boy, give us a feel for how the IRS is weighing in on this.
Yeah, so the IRS was supposed to be maybe releasing some clarifications on this. They haven't really commented on cryptocurrencies since April of 2014. So obviously the value has changed a lot since then. The way people look at it has changed a lot since then. So people are kind of itching for an update from the IRS on how exactly to go about paying taxes. And they have not yet released one. They are known for releasing their opinions very close to the individual filing deadline. So some people I spoke to suggested just waiting to file until maybe there's some more clarity.
What else struck you as you were pulling this together? Because this was such a surprise to me. Anything else jump out at you?
I think it's interesting that a lot of accountants probably don't have intensive knowledge of this. So some people were suggesting maybe going to an accountant who specializes in Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies, and I know that it might be a little more difficult to find. I mean, there's not a section on TurboTax yet for crypto, so...
Thanks, Carrie. Carrie Paul, MarketWatch personal finance reporter. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for three straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in defense, cybersecurity, mobility, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan among the top 10 states in the country for business. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. Small business never stops moving, so Dell's U.S.-based small business technology advisors are trained to keep up. Just call 877-BUY-DELL to get connected with an advisor who will get to know your business and tailor a solution with Dell PCs powered by Intel Core processors that is right for you, so you can focus on your business and leave the tech questions to Dell. Call 877-BUY-DELL to get in touch with a tech advisor today. Glad you could join us. If you've been holding on to Beanie Babies with hopes they'd one day be valuable, it might be time to just give them away to a good cause. Two decades after the great Beanie Baby boom, where old and young hit Hallmark stores around the country in search of rare examples, collectors are having trouble even getting a thin dime for them. Although that hasn't prevented some people from listing them online for thousands of bucks. More from Wall Street Journal reporter Shabani Matani. Shabani, what are you hearing?
Everyone remembers the Beanie Babies, that craze that exploded in the 90s. And people are back trying to sell their Beanie Babies for thousands of dollars. There's some in particular that people say are worth $10,000. I've seen listings up to $50,000. But it's all fake news, as they say. Nobody wants your Beanie Babies, and they're not worth as much money as some of these collectors think.
Oh, my goodness. What has happened, I guess? Why are they not collector's items?
Right. So I guess, I've spoken to a couple of toy appraisers and antique dealers, and they say the problem with Beanie Babies is that too many of them were produced, and when people bought them, they bought them to collect because of all the hype and the frenzy around them in the 1990s. Real rare toys are toys that people actually played with and, you know, got scuffed up and lost. And now it's really, really hard to find mint versions of those toys, right? So, like, tin toys from the 1920s, they said, extremely rare and valuable. But Beanie Babies, there were just too many of them, and it was a bubble that was doomed to fail.
So which ones are listing for tens of thousands of dollars?
Yeah, the one in particular that people have, like, gone crazy over and been speculating about is the Princess Diana Bear. That was released after her death, and it was the 20th anniversary of her death last August. And people thought, okay, wow, like, the time's right. We're going to sell these bears for, like, tens of thousands of dollars. Except the bear was made for charity, so there are lots of them. And they're really not that valuable at all. So,
boy, the one, I think it was a one, like, professional collector, right? He said, yeah, just give them away. There's no value. And he doesn't see that there might one day be any value?
Yeah, so that was interesting. He was saying that the problem with Beanie Babies was that they were the toys of the millennial generation, right? Like, so they were played a lot within the 1990s by people who are now in their late 20s and 30s. And that generation doesn't collect. So unlike the generations before them, they're not really into, you know, holding on to lots of stuff. They're more minimalist and they move around a lot. Mm. And that's really interesting. So they're predicting that Beanie Babies are not going to come back.
Wow. So how many different types of stories are out there trying to push the idea that they are valuable?
Yeah, so there have just been, like, so many different articles that keep going viral over and over again. There was one that is titled, If You Have These 10 Beanie Babies, You Can Retire Tomorrow, and so on. But you know, that's kind of from the reality.
Shabani, Wall Street Journal Midwest correspondent Shabani Matani. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for joining us. With a nod to the Oscars on Sunday night, we thought we'd ask about how enthusiastic you are about movies. Are you an Oscar completist, as they're known? To be one, you have to see all 59 feature-length and short films up for awards. That means all the nominees in every category. These junkies can watch on their phones at work, or regrettably, as some admit, on their laptops while commuting. This year, Brian Stoops, a marketing manager in San Diego, is making his first stab at Oscar completion. He's seen 56 films so far, according to the Wall Street Journal. He drove more than an hour to catch the Russian divorce drama Loveless up for Best Foreign Language Film. Adam Waldowski recalls watching the 2007 Bob Dylan movie I'm Not There in Branson, Missouri, when a fire alarm went off in the theater. He rolled the dice and stayed. Not his proudest moment, he admits. Marty Hell remembers driving 140 miles in a blizzard from his home in Austin, Minnesota to Ames, Iowa, just to see Mandela, Long Walk to Freedom. It was one of only a few theaters in the U.S. still playing the film. He recalls thinking to himself in the blizzard, this is really dumb. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend